This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Labor Day has come and gone, and so presidential campaigning has kicked up a notch, especially among those who are banking on a strong showing in the Granite State. One of them is Democratic contender Bernie Sanders, who spoke at a union breakfast.
The reason that people are working longer hours, and in some cases not making enough money to feed their kids, is that for many Americans, wages in this country are just too damn low.
Another candidate investing a lot of time here is Ohio Governor John Kasich. Speaking at a national security forum in Concord, Kasich said he'd send American troops to defeat ISIS, although at this point, he said, it's impossible to know how big an effort would be needed.
I can't tell you how many, enough to get the job done. The most important thing for a commander-in-chief is to decide the direction. That's the thrust of what a commander-in-chief has to do.
Meanwhile, the city of Franklin voted to reinstate its 9 p.m. curfew for kids under age 16. Franklin manager Elizabeth Dragon called the curfew another tool for city police.
When they see, you know, young adults under the age of 16 out and about late hours of the night and early hours of the morning to bring them back home to their parents and sort of check in with them.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. Let's hear from you. Call in The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests for this week's Roundup are Dan Barrick, Senior Editor for Politics and Policy here at NHPR. Dan, thanks for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Gary Reno, State House Reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. Gary, welcome back.
Thank you.
And as always, Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, thanks for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, and gentlemen, let's start with gubernatorial politics here in the Granite State. And Dan Barrick, Republican Executive Counselor Chris Sununu this week announcing he's running for governor. What do you make of this?
Well, it was not necessarily a surprise. His name has been bandied about for some time as a potential candidate for governor. The timing was a little bit of a surprise. Was in Salem, his family's hometown, at the Labor Day ceremonies. It's obviously his name. His family's been involved in state politics for going on 30 years now. Son of a former governor, brother of a former senator. He's been an executive counselor for 5 years now. Which, you know, as some people may know, it's kind of an obscure office even in New Hampshire. I think a lot of voters may not necessarily know what it does. But he represents, you know, one-fifth of the state. It's a position that's somewhat administrative, mostly votes on contracts and appointments, you know, usually not very controversial. His name was in the news earlier this summer for a vote that the council took on whether to give some family contracts to Planned Parenthood that deal with family planning services. He voted against that. He also described himself as pro-choice Republican. That for that and other reasons, he's often described as a moderate within the party. But I think, you know, he's young. He is the manager of the Waterville Valley Resort. Obviously, his family history. I think he'll be an interesting candidate. There may be some other Republicans waiting in the wings. It seems like pretty much half of the Republicans in the Senate are potential candidates. Jeanne Forrester, the chair of the Senate Budget Committee, Senate President Chuck Morse, Majority Leader Jeb Bradley, all Republicans are possible candidates. There may be other names. But it's an interesting start to the gubernatorial race for not least of the reasons that we don't necessarily know whether incumbent Governor Maggie Hassan will be on the ballot for that race. We don't
That's
know
the big question,
right,
isn't it?
Right. So I think in some ways it was an effort by Sununu to kind of just make some news in this race and just sort of, you know, plant his flag and get off the mark.
Yeah, go ahead, Gary.
I think it was one of the more curious things about it was the way the announcement was made. I mean, he didn't put out any pre-notice to anybody. He just sort of shows up and makes this announcement, which is, you know, and he makes it on Labor Day when all these presidential candidates are in New Hampshire. I mean, if you're going to make an announcement for governor, you usually want to have a nice, clear opportunity where you can make big news. You can be the big news of the day. And he wasn't going to be the big news of the day when he did it the way he did it. And everybody was playing catch up and what's going on here. And I mean, it seemed like it was a sort of like a preemptive announcement. He just wanted to get in before somebody else did. It was very curious the way the whole thing went down.
Well, and Dean, I wanted to ask you, Dan mentioned the Planned Parenthood voting and Chris Sununu calling himself pro-choice, but taking some heat for his vote against Planned Parenthood funding. How does that play out?
Oh, I certainly it will certainly sort of add more fuel to the fire in terms of the Democratic response to announcing his candidacy. I agree with Gary. I thought the timing was unusual. I mean, that weekend, Labor Day weekend, is usually all about presidential politics during a presidential year, and it did kind of catch people a little bit by surprise. But we had been speculating for some time that he might get in. A couple of things that interest me. I think that the fascinating parallel with the Bush family here, you have a father and a brother who are already well established, have held statewide office. The father is governor, the brother is a U.S. senator, and now he's the third one running for a major statewide office. It's kind of interesting to see the parallels with the Bushes. So it'll be interesting for me to see sort of how the kind of long-standing kind of support and grudges of different people within the party sort of play out, given that he's a member of a very well-known and what has traditionally been a powerful political family. And the other thing, as Dan was mentioning, was figuring out how he's going to position himself. Is he going to be a moderate? Is he going to move a little bit to the right in some of his policies? What I've heard from him so far sounds fairly standard in terms of Republican positioning, but this whole kind of where he is on women's reproductive rights and abortion and Planned Parenthood, I think a lot of the initial Democratic attack is going to focus on that and the Sununu family.
Again, the exchange number for you to join us on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Join us as we catch up on some of the top New Hampshire headlines of the week. And one more question on this, Dean, to you. Yeah. It's been some time since New Hampshire had a Republican governor. What does the GOP need to do to win back that corner office?
It's certainly a challenge. Maggie Hassan's approval ratings have been consistently high, as were John Lynch's. Presidential election years in recent years here, if you look at 2008 and 2012, you've had pretty strong Democratic margins at the polls. I think that will be a challenge for him as well. I think it's basically within the party is figuring out how to kind of build a coalition that includes both conservatives. He needs conservative energy behind him, but also bringing in moderates and independents as well, who in recent years, even if they voted for Republicans further down the ticket or at the top, sometimes they voted for John Lynch in large numbers, they voted for Maggie Hassan. So he's got to figure out how to take back some of that without losing the base of his party. But, you know, running as a Republican in the state in a presidential year raises kind of the challenge of much stronger Democratic turnout than you see in midterms like 2010 and 2014.
Interesting. And Dan mentioned Governor Hassan. Gary, you're at the State House. Lots of speculation there, I'm guessing, about which way she's going to go.
Oh, it is. I mean, you can make a case for either way, really. I mean, she's stuck in the middle right now because of the budget issues that are going on. She said she's not going to make an announcement until after this is settled. But, you still see a lot of people who are convinced that she's running for U.S. Senate, and you see people who are convinced that she's staying right where she is.
Well, and so when this is settled, that's the magic word.
It
Dan
is.
Barrick, yeah, what it, can you tell us?
I mean, it could be Wednesday. That's very unlikely. The legislature is getting back to consider her veto of the Republican-backed budget. It could be any time, really. I mean, in some ways, if you look historically, she's not under any great time pressure. We're more than a year out from the actual election we're talking about, November 2016. this is not – there's not some crucial deadline that she needs to make. And in many ways, what it really has to do with within the Democratic Party is sort of the domino effect. So if she runs for Senate, which up-and-coming Democrat will run for the governor's office? If she chooses to run for re-election to the corner office, which, you know, as yet unknown Democrat will run against Republican Kelly Ayotte, a very strong incumbent. So I think in some ways there's a little bit of anxiety there.
So things can shake out.
Yeah, and we may actually get an answer sooner than we think. A week from Saturday is the state Democratic convention, which in some ways every Democratic presidential candidate will be there, so that'll be a lot of the news. But I think a lot of people will be looking to see whether Governor Hassan makes any statement, you know, very explicitly or implicitly about her political future.
Well, and both you and Gary alluded to this. So about the budget, and Governor Hassan has said, you know, I can't make a decision until this is settled. I mean, you mentioned something about this Wednesday, Dan. There's a vote at the State House on not necessarily the budget, but on the governor's veto.
Right.
Just untangle that for
sure.
us, please.
Sure. So the legislature, dominated by Republicans, passed their version of the budget in June. That was set to take effect on July 1st. The governor vetoed that. Citing, as you know, you've discussed many times, numerous concerns, the main one being cuts to the state business taxes. But according to the legislative calendar, both the House and the Senate will now take up basically whether to override that veto, to undo her veto and pass the budget over that veto. That's on Wednesday. Seems very unlikely. You need a two-thirds majority of both of each chamber to undo a veto, with Democrats pretty much in uniform support behind her. That seems unlikely, but it's part of the process. There'll be a lot of posturing, I think. But as far as I can tell, there's no deal in the offing. But you know that will be presented after that vote.
So then what, Gary?
Well, I think that we may not see a vote on the veto actually. Because if they sustain the veto and which essentially would kill the budget bills, we got to go back to square one. And
whoa, back to square one with the whole budget?
With the whole thing. I mean, it's like killing the bill. So I don't – you know, they don't really want to go through all that again. So if they pull back the vote on it, then we can still negotiate for a while. And I think that's more likely what we'll see, because I don't think they have the time, even if they have an agreement. I mean, they're probably working all the time right now, but I mean, even if they get an agreement at this point, it's a pretty short time period to sell it to everybody, which is what they're going to have to do. And so I doubt that we have anything, unless it's a super deal that everybody can buy into all, and it goes very quickly, but otherwise, it's going to take some time to sell it, and you just don't have the time to do that. So I would be very surprised if we vote on it. If we vote on it, it means it's really the whole thing's fallen apart.
Wow. Okay. Well, one thing's for certain. I know what we're going to talk about on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup next week. What is happening after this possible vote on Wednesday or not, as Gary just told us? Coming up, we'll turn to the presidential race with candidates stretching from south to north, including one who's riding a Harley around the Granite State. We'll find out more. Stay with us for the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We turn now to presidential politics, and let's hear from you. What presidential candidates are you watching as they travel around the Granite State? We'd love to hear from you. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. With me in studio, Dan Barrick, Senior Editor for Politics and Policy here at NHPR, Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, and Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And all of you, lots and lots to catch up on in the presidential race, including some interviews that you had, Dean Spiliotis. But first, Chris Christie, Dean, heading to the North Country, where few candidates go. How did that go for Governor Christie?
Yeah, you know, Chris Christie really is kind of playing by the traditional New Hampshire retail politics playbook. You know, we've said all along that for candidates like him and also others like John Kasich and Jeb Bush, New Hampshire would be an important part of their strategy. It turns out Christie is one of the individuals who seems to basically be staking his candidacy on New Hampshire. We've seen other candidates in the past, like Rudy Giuliani, attempt to do this. Doesn't always work out. He's doing lots of town halls, as you mentioned. He went up to Berlin. He's been running ads on television, talking about foreign policy, talking about the opioid crisis in the state, getting good attendance at these town halls. It does not seem to be helping him. It's, you know, one of the fascinating stories in this election has been kind of watching what a difference 4 years has made for Chris Christie. If you remember back in 2012, a number of big donors in the party and other insiders were basically begging Christie to run for president.
Really?
They flew in. They met with him. They tried to get him. Instead, he did that quick. He went up to Dartmouth and he endorsed Mitt Romney to sort of end the speculation. It's just a very different time for him. You know, he's sort of viewed as kind of so. Not only has he sort of lost that kind of momentum from 4 years ago, but on top of that, you know, he's always been kind of presented as this kind of straight talking, blunt individual, and that was sort of his kind of distinctive style. But now we have Donald Trump, and you know, in some sense, Christie pales in comparison in terms of the kind of bluntness and sort of ability to grab the headlines with, you know, sort of very colorful statements, et cetera. So on two fronts now, he's kind of lost the momentum of 2012. And he's sort of been eclipsed as kind of a blunt speaking person from the New York metropolitan area, obviously from, you know, New Jersey. So no one's really quite sure what he can do at this point. But he's been struggling in the polls, not getting a lot of traction. But he is sort of doing a lot of retail politicking in comparison to a number of the other candidates.
Well, it's tough, Dan, right? I mean, there's so many candidates on the Republican side. It's a tough task to make yourself stand out, be different.
It is. I mean, it's a crowded field. I mean, one thing I'd say is, you never know how these kinds of investments on the ground will pay off. I mean, in past years, we were saying the same things about John McCain, you know, in 2012 about how he was slogging away. But, you know, behind the scenes in a lot of these small town hall events that are not drawing national or local press, there are connections being made that may or may not pay off, depending on how the rest of the field shakes out, who fades. And Christie is logging that on the ground time right now. That we're not, you know, he's not seeing the dividends now. But that's, you know, as he says many times on the trail, we're a long way before counting any votes in New Hampshire.
Well, and fair enough. It's only September. The primary is not till February. So he's just doing that old fashioned retail, you know, going door to door. And if the media doesn't notice, who cares?
Right. But as Dean said, there are a number of candidates who are following that old playbook. Some with better success than others. Carly Fiorina is. Hit my campaign trail hard, John Kasich and others. So there's a lot of competition for those town hall audiences at this point.
Sure. Go ahead, Gary.
At this point, you know, it's sort of all up in the air where we're talking about. I mean, as we get closer to the election, it's all about the ground game. And, I mean, it's who's putting together the good ground game now. I mean, it's not going to show up in the polls per se. But when you get closer to the election, it's turning out your votes and knowing where they are. And that's a whole different ballgame.
Well, and speaking of candidates who are busy traveling the state, playing that ground game, as you put it, Gary, Scott Walker got some attention this week for touring the state on a Harley, including also some visits to the North Country. Here's a little piece of sound of Skip Rollins of Newport. He's a Scott Walker supporter and turned out to see Walker during his motorcycle tour over the weekend.
I like how he's passed the right to work bill out there, which is huge. There's just a lot of things about him. The guy, and on top of that, the guy is just totally down to earth. He's how many people running for president you ever seen get on a motorcycle and tour a state? And he doesn't have the attitude that he's better than someone else does. And that goes a long ways with me.
So that, again, that's Scott Walker supporter Skip Rollins. And what about the Scott Walker campaign, Dean Spiliotis?
Sure. I should point out that I think John Kerry in 2004 occasionally would ride from place to place mm-hmm. on a Harley Davidson as well. It's been interesting. You know, he was on, as we mentioned, his goal was to ride through all 10 counties in the state. It was beautiful weather, a bit warm actually, but very good weather, and he had a group of people riding with him. Democrats were sort of gleeful to point out that he was touring the state on a Harley Davidson, which is a union built motorcycle, and he's sort of known as a sort of, you know, no friend of the unions with the right to work bill in Wisconsin. So you know, they took to Twitter immediately, you know, anti-union candidate on a union bike. But that said, there's sort of bigger issues I think that Scott Walker has to deal with. You know, he was the front runner for a long time in kind of the preseason, just
lots
based,
of excitement.
Yeah,
about
just based
his,
on kind of how he looked on paper, his success in Wisconsin. But a lot of us said, well, let's wait and see how he does once he starts campaigning. And I have to say, ever since he has started campaigning, his numbers have steadily declined. Now, there's a lot of pressure on him to reverse that. He's trying right now to kind of reboot with a couple of big speeches. It's one of the big stories that analysts are talking about is, you know, why has he been unable to capitalize, and particularly in Iowa, where he was the big favorite for some time. And it may have to do with his campaigning. It may have to do with other people getting into the race, kind of changing how people think about it. But for whatever reason, this is a guy who people thought would be one of the key Republican players, and it hasn't happened for him yet either.
Gary, go ahead.
Well, I mean, we've seen this all along in this whole primary play out. I mean, Rand Paul, he's all of a sudden the flavor of the month, and Mario Rubio.
That's right. We haven't seen Rand Paul in a while, have we?
And even Chris Christie from back when. I mean, and they all have been the flavor of the month, and they've all sort of fallen back down into the pack.
Well, and speaking of Iowa, I hope our friends in Iowa aren't listening, because here's an email from Alan in Durham who says, regardless of who wins, Iowa is easily the most irrelevant demographic outpost this side of Montana, Wyoming, and the Dakotas. Alan says, how do I know this? Last I checked, there's no President Huckabee, 2008 winner, or President Santorum, 2012. Alan, thank you very much for the question. You know, this does raise a question in my mind regarding, you know, the New Hampshire primary. Who, Dean, is really working Iowa? We've been talking about the candidates who are really working New Hampshire. We've talked about Chris Christie. We've talked about John Kasich. We're going to talk in a minute about Bernie Sanders. Who's working the ground in Iowa?
As a matter of fact, the 2012 winner, Rick Santorum, was the first Republican candidate to visit all 99 counties in Iowa. They call that doing the full Grassley after Senator Grassley in Iowa, who every year tries to visits all 99 counties. This is the point that the emailer was getting at is the Iowa caucus, particularly on the Republican side, is dominated by evangelicals. Something like 60 to 65% of caucus goers are evangelical. It's become a very good place for social and religious conservatives to campaign, whether it's Huckabee or Santorum or Bobby Jindal. Ben Carson is doing very well there. Trump is in the lead for whatever reason. And there have been, we saw Ben Carson just yesterday kind of question Donald Trump's sort of the sort of reality of his religiosity. He's talked about the Bible. Carson is not persuaded that he's a particularly religious individual. So all of that's going to play out in Iowa. The problem is when you go to other states like New Hampshire, those kinds of candidates don't play well here. We're the second least religious state in the country behind Vermont, according to the Pew Trust. And candidates sort of Santorum, Huckabee, I've watched them do well in Iowa. They come to New Hampshire. They lose traction, and that's pretty much it. And
they hope to hold on till South Carolina. But even
South Carolina doesn't quite fit the sort of Iowa demographic. And on the Democratic side, as Gary said, it's all about organization. And I think, 2004, Howard Dean was in the lead, and it turned out he didn't have the organization to turn people out in Iowa. The Clinton organization is building a strong organization out there. Sanders has now pulled even with her. Questions about how strong his organization will be need to be answered as well.
All right. Well, Alan, thank you for the email. You can join us, too, by email like Alan did, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter, or give us a phone call, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange@nhpr.org. One or two more questions about the Republicans, and then I do want to turn to the Democrats. And Dan, to you, on September 16th, the next Republican debate takes place in California, not New Hampshire, but what do you think New Hampshire voters, Republican voters, will be watching for in that next debate?
Well, they'll probably be looking for the same things that Republican voters across the country are, which is, who we saw at the last debate, who really tried to stand out or who made an impression. Because when you've got these people that are campaigning individually, they're kind of doing their own thing, to have them all on the same stage. And I think, two people who obviously stood out last time were Carly Fiorina, who was in sort of the undercard debate.
The kids' table debate.
Right, but really elevated herself to the point where her supporters and many other unallied Republicans were able to persuade CNN to change somewhat the criteria they were using to admit candidates to reflect her surge. And I think John Kasich, too, who's been this, a fairly late entrant to the race, who's benefited from this introductory phase where he's able to, talk about his biography and introduce himself. And we're starting to see, the point in the campaign, in his campaign, where he's starting to talk a little bit more concretely about policy, about foreign policy, and his support of some measures like Medicaid expansion. So whether some of those candidates get pressed a little bit more for specifics now that we're moving beyond that kind of introductory phase, now that a lot of these candidates are becoming better known. So just kind of seeing that contrast. And I think, one of the things, too, that candidates, Dean alluded to it, are testing out as the summer's gone on is on the Republican side how to respond to Donald Trump. And we saw a couple of those messages tested out. Rand Paul, the last debate, came out pretty hard taking on Donald Trump. Didn't seem to really benefit him very much in public opinion or on the campaign trail. It'd be interesting to see if other candidates try and directly confront Trump and some of the questions that are, you know, continue to being raised about his level of policy mastery and how that affects his candidacy.
And then you've got Ted Cruz and Donald Trump almost campaigning together,
right,
which is another interesting dynamic. Given your long knowledge of Granite State voters, Gary Reyna, what do you think they're going to be looking for when they watch this debate?
Well, I think they're going to be looking for the engagement at some point. I mean, as Dan said, we've been having all these events and everything, but we haven't had a lot of engagement between the candidates. And it's certainly starting to happen now. I mean, we have people going after Donald Trump in ads like George Bush and so on. I mean, we're just starting to mix it up a little bit. And I think, we do have to start getting to the issues, and let's start really talking about some of the main issues that we're dealing with.
And we will get to see Carly Fiorina on the main stage. At CNN, yeah, there was a whole thing about how they were deciding who was going to be on the stage, and they altered the criteria, and so she's going to be the 11th person on the stage. And
I was going to ask you that, Dean. Yeah. How many people this time?
It's going to be 11, I believe. So there were, originally I thought maybe like she would replace Chris Christie, but it now looked like there's going to be 11, and then a sort of an early debate, a pre-debate again for roughly 5 or 6 of the other candidates.
Okay, so they are going to do that again.
They are. I think one.
They call it the happy hour.
Yeah, happy hour, yeah. The kids table. There's all kinds of unfortunate names for it. the main debate is at 8 o'clock, and then the other debate is maybe an hour or two before that. I'm not quite sure, but they're both going to be on. And she's interesting. You know, she had great success and got a real bounce out of the last debate. Some people believe now with her on the main stage, people are going to start asking her about, you know, why did you get fired at Hewlett-Packard? Why did you lose the Senate race against Barbara Boxer in California? That the gloves are going to come off a little bit, but she certainly has capitalized on that first experience. I think it's just one of the things we'll be looking for.
Okay, well, and Dean, on the Republican side and on some of those candidates who might be at the kids' table, Lindsey Graham, South Carolina senator, impressive foreign policy credentials, super good buddy of John McCain and Kelly Ayotte. Yeah. You're going to be talking to Senator Graham this coming week, right?
Tonight. Afternoon is sort of the next in our series of these Pints and Politics interviews we do at the Barley House. This one's going to be 5 o'clock today. It's open to the public. We're going to have Lindsey Graham, who's bringing John McCain along for the ride. So we'll have both of them. McCain and Graham are good friends. They're two of the three amigos. It used to be Joe Lieberman as well, but he retired. We'll be talking to Graham. You know, he's in a tough position. This public policy polling, which some people say is kind of a Democratic polling operation, but nonetheless, it's a pretty well-known poll. They asked South Carolinians whether Lindsey Graham should get out of the race, and something like 82% said he should get out of the race. There's been some grumbling among elites in South Carolina that Graham is kind of blocking them from endorsing. Until he gets out of the race, they don't feel comfortable endorsing other candidates.
Which they want to do because they have an early position.
Exactly. And his approval rating has dropped from about 54% to 36% in South Carolina. So the run for as much as people like talking to him in New Hampshire, and he's also been doing the retail politics wall-to-wall here, seems to really be enjoying himself. It seems to be starting to have some repercussions for him in South Carolina. You know, he was just reelected for 6 years, so he's got time to kind of deal with that. But he's in a tough spot. Very hawkish ad running on TV now here in New Hampshire from him about how to deal with ISIS and the crisis in the Middle East. So he's an interesting part of the process, but he's in a tough spot right now.
All right. Well, I'll definitely follow up with you next week.
Sure.
On how that went, Dean. But I do want to turn for a couple minutes to the Democrats. Now, I want to let everyone know that we're doing a whole show looking at the Democratic side on Monday. So we'll just spend a couple minutes on it now, but a whole hour on Monday. First off, gentlemen, a new candidate jumped in on the Democratic side this week. Harvard professor Lawrence Lessig announced his campaign in Claremont on Wednesday. Lessig said all other policy concerns, no matter what, the economy, ISIS, whatever, must wait until campaign finance reform is achieved.
I don't care what your issue is. You might be somebody that actually cares about 2 or 3 issues. It doesn't matter. Every one of these issues depends on solving this fundamental issue first. And once we solve it, I think it's possible to imagine dealing with those issues.
So again, that's Harvard professor Lawrence Lessig, a well-known campaign finance reformer, announcing his campaign for president. What do you make of this, Dan?
Well, it's another surprising and interesting aspect of this year's race. I mean, he's a well-known, as you said, he's a well-known figure on this issue. He both nationally and also in New Hampshire. I mean, he was involved in this New Hampshire rebellion last year, which marched from, you know, the length of the state to try and call attention to the corrupting influence of money in politics. He was behind this May Day PAC, which tried to raise money to support candidates, including one in New Hampshire here who backed campaign finance reform.
Jim Rubens, right?
Republican, actually. He said that his frustration over this issue that he feels, you know, actually entering the race himself is the main way. I mean, in some ways, it's certainly calling attention to this. This issue has risen as a main concern of voters to the point that actually earlier this week, Hillary Clinton released a detailed plan on how she would deal with campaign finance reform. In some ways, you could say sort of, you know, stealing, taking a little bit of the air out of the you know, Lessig's reason for campaigning. But I think if nothing else, you know, it shows, I mean, in some ways, it will force, I think, especially on the Democratic side, candidates to talk more explicitly about this issue.
One more question about the Democrats. Gary, I'll start with you. Vermont Senator and Democratic candidate Bernie Sanders keeps chugging along, doing very well. Love your thoughts on that first, and I have another question, Gary.
Well, I think, I mean, it's he's saying all the right things. He's energizing that wing of the Democratic Party that really has felt like they've been neglected for a long time, that they haven't had candidates that they could really support. They've been told to, you know, hold your nose and vote for the guy in the center so we can get win the election. And they finally have somebody who's out there saying what they've always believed, you know, the progressive end of the Democratic Party. And these people are charged up. They're showing up here, there, and everywhere. He's drawing huge crowds.
Kind of like the crowds that used to follow another Vermont politician, right? Howard Dean,
right.
They were also very charged up
were,
on the left.
And, I mean, I guess Bernie's challenge is to not end up like Howard Dean, which is to see his campaign go up in smoke after a couple of Ohio, I mean, Iowa and New Hampshire.
Well, or end up like Bill Bradley. Dan Balls, the Washington Post reporter, Dean Spiliotis, did a comparison between Clinton and Sanders to Gore and Bradley in 1999.
Yeah, absolutely. Howard Dean, Bill Bradley, some people mentioned Gary Hart. The big challenge for Bernie Sanders is going to be to show, particularly once we get past Iowa and New Hampshire, that he can bring in other elements of the Democratic coalition. African Americans, Latinos, Asians all voted in very high numbers for Obama 2012. Right now, Bernie's main support are sort of white, high education, high income progressives. And so he needs to show when he moves beyond the first couple of states, he can bring others in as well.
All right. More after a short break. Stay with us. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're catching up on some of the top Granite State headlines, and we'd like to hear from you. Join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love to get your questions and comments about some of the headlines that we're covering this week. And joining me in studio are Dan Barrick, Senior Editor for Politics and Policy here at NHPR, Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website, nhpoliticalcapital.com. One more time, that exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. And here's an email that came in earlier from Liz, who says, I'm more than disappointed that Chris Sununu, deciding vote on the Executive Council, voted to defund Planned Parenthood based on highly doctored propaganda and deprive New Hampshire men and women of a highly efficient health care provider. So that's Liz in Londonderry. Thank you, Liz, for the email. And Dean, we talked about this a little bit earlier, but go ahead and circle back there.
Yeah, this issue with the Planned Parenthood contracts going to feed into the larger debate nationally. We've seen, you know, just to take a step back, in Congress, we're going to be talking about the need to continue to fund the government. And there are some Republicans in the House and Senate who want to block any kind of funding resolution because of this Planned Parenthood issue. So, sure. So, you know, by Sununu kind of agreeing to block that contract, you know, he's kind of taken a stand that sort of puts him in the middle of this issue. And again, as the emailer referred to, the larger issue of these videos that were edited and, you know, whether or not you think what they were doing was illegal or legal or maybe just was kind of, you know, sort of more in terms of the difficulty of watching the kinds of things you do in those circumstances. So, yeah, it's going to be a very kind of emotional, kind of important part of his run for governor. And I think outside groups who support Planned Parenthood will bring money into the state specifically because of this issue to go after him.
Yeah, and you make a good point. It's a national issue, too, because there may be a government shutdown over this?
Well, there may be a government shutdown regardless, but there are some Republicans who are saying that until this is resolved and Planned Parenthood is defunded, they won't vote to continue spending.
All right, Liz, thank you for the email. And another headline that caught my attention this week, Gary Reno, is some concern about the proposed merger between Anthem and Cigna. Now, we're going to have to just start at the basics here. Anthem, obviously the largest health insurer in New Hampshire. Give us the next piece in this story.
Well, I mean, it's a $54 billion merger. So, I mean, it's like
wow,
big money. But the American Medical Association did a study of the impact of this merger, and New Hampshire would be the most impacted state if these two companies merge. And the reason that is because currently Anthem has about 60% of the business in New Hampshire, and Cigna has about 30%. So between the two of them, it's like 90% of all the people that are in health insurance in the state of New Hampshire.
Wow, that's a lot, Gary.
It certainly is. I mean, and Anthem is out there saying, well, you know, that will create a lot of efficiencies and we can be much more efficient and do a lot better job. But I think, you know, if you're a healthcare provider, number one, and a healthcare customer or insuree, then you probably have to be a little concerned about somebody with 90% of the market.
So again, the American Medical Association, Gary said, and I'm quoting here from New Hampshire Business Review, said the proposed merger of health insurance giants Anthem and Cigna would hurt competition in New Hampshire more than in any other state. That's a big statement by the AMA.
It sure is. It is. I mean, I don't imagine there's any other state where they would control almost 90% of the market.
How does this fit in, Dean, with this whole sort of concern about the health insurance exchanges under Obamacare, right? And Anthem was the only player back in 2014. And then in 2015, a couple other companies jumped in. So people said, yay, more competition. I mean, does this play into that at all, or is this a completely different story?
No, I mean, it's all part of the larger debate over how to make healthcare, you know, sort of maximize accessibility and minimize cost. And you're absolutely right. For a long time, there was a discussion that, you know, there weren't enough players in New Hampshire, and that was going to keep costs artificially high because there was no competition. And then I recall us on the roundtable having discussions about how a number of other players were going to get into the state and start offering health plans. But now you have this concern, obviously, over sort of dramatically increasing the concentration of the market share of this merger. And, you know, I read that, you know, places like Manchester and Portsmouth and the Rochester-Dover area may be most affected given kind of the concentration of plans in those areas. But Congress and I think the New Hampshire Insurance Department are going to hold hearings on this. So it's not a done deal yet.
Okay. Well, that's definitely a story to follow up on. Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can join the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup with your questions, comments, thoughts on some of the big headlines that we're covering this week. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Dan Barrick, I'd like to ask you about Franklin. That made a lot of headlines around the state this week. The city of Franklin reinstating a curfew. Just set the stage for us there, Dan, if you could, please.
Sure. So it's a curfew that would apply to kids under the age of 16. They'd have to be, you know, sort of, as you might expect, they'd have to be, I think, can't be out on the street after 9 p.m. on weekdays and after 11 on weekends. The city had this for some years and had phased it out. And, you know, there's some other communities around the state. In fact, Somersworth decided to institute one just earlier this week. But it's pretty basic need or perceived need that they're trying to address, which is, you know, young kids unsupervised on the streets. One, you know, the interesting pushback from the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union of New Hampshire, saying that this is, you know, violates civil rights and parents' ability to tend to their kids. So they vowed to challenge this, even though it has been on the books in Franklin in the past and in other communities. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, what kind of a legal story follows from this.
Yeah, it's interesting. And Gary, I'd love your thoughts.
Well, it's been an issue for a while, but I mean, we've had an awful lot of curfews around the state. I mean, there are quite a few cities and towns that have it. And not much has been written about it, but this one becomes very public when the ACLU jumps in and says that we really think it's a constitutional issue that interferes with parental rights and with the rights of young people who will be forced to interact with the police department at some point if we keep going along this way.
Well, you do wonder how it's going to shake out, Dean. I mean, it will take police time and energy to deal with this. On the other hand, maybe people in Franklin think that it's something that needs to be dealt with. When you think of kids, you know, they said it was in response to kids congregating, concerns about kids congregating late at night. Yeah. I'm surprised that they're under 16. I would think it would be the older kids, but clearly I'm wrong about that.
Right. And, you know, my understanding was this was a pretty easy vote for the city council, so there must have been something, you know, sort of things on the ground driving this. And it had been in effect for 20 years. You know, Franklin is a city just, you know, a little bit north of here in Concord that we read about a lot in the newspaper, and they've been sort of undergoing a lot of attempts to kind of bring the city back and become kind of a development for new kinds of entrepreneurship and also upgrading and renovating the kind of physical structures of Main Street.
So
there's been a lot going on there to try to kind of bring the city back. And so, you know, this may sort of feed into that larger desire to kind of make it an appealing place for families to settle or for people to come in the evenings. You know, if the ACLU sues, you know, the state allows cities and towns to create these curfews. So I don't know if they would sue Franklin or the city council and also the state. I'm not sure how that would work legally. But these things are fairly common.
Well, it's interesting. And I was thinking back about my own childhood. The town I grew up in did have an air horn that went off at, I guess it was 9 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And I was sort of laughing because we didn't hear that and go, oh, we got to go inside. It felt like a time check. Like, oh, it's 8 o'clock or it's 9 o'clock. We didn't. So it will be interesting to see what happens in Franklin. Again, the number for you to join the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And guys, we really do need to spend a couple minutes just acknowledging that today is 9/11. It just seems unbelievable that it's been 14 years. And Gary Rayner, I'm looking at you because you've been covering this date for a long time, and I just would love your reflections.
Well, my reflection is actually very personal. For years, my mother worked with a trust fund that was to help needy people in the town of Wilmot. And one of the things they used to do was distribute baskets at Christmas and at Thanksgiving. And one of the people who were, for many years, the person that went around with my mother was Thelma Cuccinello, who lived in Wilmot, lived up on Mount Kearsarge. And she was on the plane, first plane that was flown into the World Trade Center. And, I mean, it's that sort of, I think there are a lot of people who have that very direct impact from this. I mean, I have an aunt and uncle who live out on Long Island. And, I mean, they were telling me right after this, I mean, all these people that they knew that lost their lives in this. And it's just, you know, it's very real to a lot of people, and it continues to be very real to a lot of people.
Yeah, and it's always kind of creepy to me when I fly out of Logan. I think, oof.
I know.
They left right from here. Yeah, Dean, go ahead.
Just a couple of different things that I often think about. The if you remember, in one of the towers, there was a big investment from old Cantor Fitzgerald. The CEO of that company, Howard Lutnick, was a few years ahead of me in college. I knew him. I didn't know him well, but I knew him as a college student, and I've sort of watched him. I believe he lost his brother in one of the towers. Couple of other guys I went to college with worked for him, so they were killed as well. So my college has a number of sort of buildings named after various classmates. So I often think about the impact that it's had on my school. But also, I grew up in New York, and I've noticed that as people have been putting up pictures of the towers on Twitter before the attack, it sort of is sort of oddly comforting to see, because I remember as a kid, you drive into New York and you'd see the Empire State Building, and then you look down to the left and from Long Island and you'd see the sort of really tall towers there. And it was a striking thing to see them no longer be there. We now have the Freedom Tower in its place. I'm sort of gotten used to now looking for that when I go to visit my family in New York. And the final thing is more sort of professionally, so the unbelievable, unfathomable impact it's had on politics and foreign policy in this country. the presidential race, our foreign policy.
Game-changing.
The game-changing. Absolutely. The impact. I mean, there were people who volunteered for the service after 9/11 who were either killed or seriously wounded as a result, totally changed their lives, changed the foreign policy, political dynamics, everything. And so this is something that, you know, we're still going to be dealing with for decades.
Well, and we mentioned earlier, Dean, that presidential debate that's coming up. In the last presidential debate, the loss of 9/11 came up too, right, between the more sort of government stay out of our lives, don't watch us, Rand Paul wing of the Republican Party, and the security wing represented in this instance by Chris Christie.
Yeah, and there is always going to be – there always, and I think we could also put Lindsey Graham, as someone also has talked very strongly about reengaging people, you know, sort of the enemy over there. Absolutely. There's a real tension. There has been, you know, going back to the Patriot Act a number of years – a real kind of tension between individual liberty and the responsibility of the government to kind of protect citizens in a way that a lot of us have never had to deal with before. It's just sort of really, really permanently altered things in so many ways, both in terms of personal lives and in terms of kind of the larger dynamics in our country.
Well, and you'll be talking again with Lindsey Graham tonight at the
Barley
House,
McCain,
so probably on 9/11 he'll...
Right.
He'll have some reflections. By the way, just got this note from one of my producers. Summersworth is also going to impose a curfew. So we talked earlier about Franklin. Summersworth is also going to be doing that. Well, guys, I love closing out the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup with a look at what you all will be up to next week. There is a lot going on. Dan Barrick, now that Labor Day is over, summer's not over on the calendar, but sort of psychologically, emotionally, it's over. So what are you guys going to be covering next week in the newsroom?
I mentioned a couple of the bigger news items. Obviously, on Wednesday, the veto override day will be a big deal, both policy-wise, how this resolves this budget impasse we've been dealing with for the entire summer now. But also, I'll be just kind of interested to see just rhetorically how the different players present themselves this day. We've already talked about the political implications about what it may or may not mean for Governor Hassan's future, for some of the other Senate Republicans who may be considering higher office. It's been a pretty acrimonious summer between the two sides. No real progress towards any compromise, and I'd be interested to see whether that kind of discord persists on Wednesday. At the end of the week, on the weekend, we'll be getting ready and paying attention to the state Democratic convention, which will have implications nationally for the presidential race. All the major Democratic candidates for president will be speaking there. But as I said, a lot of top state Democrats will be there. Maggie Hassan, Executive Counselor Colin Van Ostern.
Governor Van Ostern, some people say. He's considered a
right,
possible
right.
Gubernatorial
and
candidate.
And candidates for Congress as well. So just it's an opportunity for players within the party to try and, you know, send public smoke signals about their intentions, the issues they'll be focusing on, the rhetoric they'll be using to try and engage voters and talk about policy.
Wow, that's real interesting. I'm glad you mentioned the Democratic convention because, as I said earlier, on Monday, the exchange is going to sort of preview the Democratic presidential candidates. Given all the attention that we have paid to the Republicans, we're going to pay some attention to the Democratic candidates, including ones that barely get any attention, Martin O'Malley, Jim Webb, and Lincoln Chafee. So we'll be catching up on that. How about you, Gary?
I know where I'll be Wednesday, that's for sure.
Right.
And then all the talk about the budget veto and so on, we sometimes tend to forget that there are other bills that she vetoed, some of which are very large bills like the Common Core bill that would forbid the State Department of Education for mandating Common Core on local school districts, constitutional carry, which would do away with the requirement you have to have a permit to carry a concealed weapon.
Oh, constitutional carry is back, right.
And voter 30 days, the 30-day period, grace period before you could vote. There are a whole bunch of bills these are all major bills that have got vetoed. So it's not just going to be the budget on Wednesday. It's going to be a whole lot of other stuff as well.
Interesting, right. I had forgotten about all those other vetoes because the budget got so much attention.
Right. It gets overseen, you know, it just sort of overpowers everything. But we'll have some really big debates, I think, on a lot of this stuff. But given the makeup of the legislature, I don't think any of them are ever going to get overridden at this point.
Wow, a late night for Gary Reno. If you see lights on late at the State House, we know who it is. How about you, Dean?
Well, as we mentioned, I have John McCain and Lindsey Graham today at 5 p.m. at the Barley House. It's open to the public. If you want to hear my interview with Bernie Sanders from Labor Day, go to nhpoliticalcapital.com. I have a link up. I also tweet out all the information on this stuff at Dean Spiliotis if you want to follow me. So continuing with the presidential stuff, and I think Gary and Dan did a really nice job of laying out how crucial next week is for the governor, for the budget, and also for Democrats as they gear up for their big convention next weekend.
All right. Well, and as I said, we'll be looking at the Democrats on Monday. Also, midweek, we're going to talk with Josh Levs of CNN, very well-known and well-respected reporter at CNN. He's got a new book out. This will interest everyone at this table about fatherhood and workplace policies that he says need to better favor dads. So amen to that. And we'll be talking to Josh Levs on Wednesday. Guys, thank you very much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Laura.
Thank you.
Thanks, Laura.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.